Good evening, and welcome to VPR's Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party. I'm Rick Singeri, and our guest tonight is Mark Breen, who you know well from our daily Eye on the Sky weather reports and the Eye on the Night Sky program, which you hear at 4:30 in the afternoon on VPR. Mark is also the planetarium director at the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury, and he has extensive knowledge of the night sky. Mark, thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, glad to be here, Rick.
This program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum. Now, we're asking you all to go out to your backyard with a blanket and a radio and take a look at the night sky and follow along with Mark and me. And Mark, it looks like the weather's going to cooperate with us tonight.
It is in at least a third to a half of the VPR listening area. I know listeners that are heading down to approximately Route 4, that marker that we often mention. That area still seeing some clouds, but there's also some clearing that's taking place down across parts of the Berkshires and maybe edging into near Bennington. So we've got some spots that are seeing the skies clearing up very nicely.
That's good. So, Mark, let's start by getting a sense of where we are. Could you orient us to what we're seeing? Maybe help us face all the same direction.
Sure. One of the things that I find very helpful and I think relatively easy to do in an evening sky in August is to not try to pick out a whole lot of things, but just a few key elements. And one of the key things that I often look for is the Big Dipper. It's in the northwestern skies. It's one of the more familiar patterns in the sky. So if you look northwest right now, about a third of the way up, maybe a quarter of the way up from the horizon, you should see seven medium bright stars with three stars kind of arcing on the top part to the left and then four stars, sort of a rectangle-ish kind of box, down to the lower right of that. That is the classic. That is the Big Dipper. And from there, we'll do one more thing. We can use those stars to find one other key star that you'll want to find. The two outside edge stars on the dipper part, so not the handle part, but the dipper part, if you connect those two stars with an imaginary line and then extend it about the same distance that the Big Dipper is long, then you'll get to another relatively bright star, halfway up in the sky, exactly in the north. You might have guessed it from that description. It is the North Star, not necessarily the brightest star in the sky, but that's a great star to be familiar with, and you always can find it by using the Big Dipper. It points to the North Star. So there's a kind of a key couple of things in the north. Now, if you're looking to the east and you look way up, sky is now starting to lose most of its twilight, so you may be getting a thin film of the Milky Way showing up high in the east. But key thing to look for, and it's almost at the top of the sky, really bright star up there, it's a star named Vega. Off to its right and a little bit lower, another bright star, more in the Milky Way itself, a star named Altair, and that is the second of a three-star grouping, the third one going back to the left, a little bit below Vega and a little bit more to the left. That star, not quite as bright as the other two, but still noticeably bright, that is Deneb, and I mentioned all three of those because that is the summer triangle. Relatively speaking, an easy group to find, and so that's another key place to look in the sky. So again, that's pretty high up in the east, and over the course of the evening, it'll slide a little bit more toward the southeast. And speaking of sliding toward the southeast, we'll even continue on to the south itself, and there, maybe just a little right of south, but in the general vicinity, if you're looking in the south, relatively low in the sky, not very high up, look for a bright reddish star. Don't mistake it for Mars. It is indeed a red star. It's a star named Antares. It's the heart of Scorpio the Scorpion. Again, it's another key thing that is unique in the sky. You're not going to see another bright red star in the evening sky, so making that connection and also giving you a pretty good degree of confidence that you're going to find that particular star. And then, although it's certainly obvious, but it isn't a permanent situation. So in other words, those three groupings, Big Dipper, Summer Triangle, Red Star, and Scorpio, they're going to be there every night for the next couple of weeks in those basic positions. But something that is there only for tonight, and that's going to be the moon a nice crescent moon. It's kind of low in the west southwest, but all of us can recognize the moon, so that's kind of nice. Also, kind of a fat crescent moon, as it's described sometimes. It's a nice thick crescent moon above the moon, and just a little bit to its left, but basically above the moon, kind of a bright object. That is the planet Saturn. And if you're, let's say you have a chance to look tomorrow night, I understand the weather isn't necessarily looking like it'll cooperate, but sometimes you never know. A little break in the clouds and you may be all set. But so tomorrow night, you'll see the same arrangement, but this time the moon will have progressed to the left of Saturn. So Saturn will be on its right. So that'd be something to kind of take note that over a few nights, the moon will gradually position itself more toward the left and heading off toward the southern skies. But there's kind of the basic setup that you'll find this evening.
So, Mark, as you are orienting us, Liza wrote in. She's from Marshfield, and she asks if Polaris, the North Star, helps us find north in the northern hemisphere. Is there a counterpart or a South Star that helps the same for stargazers in the southern hemisphere? Just in case someone's listening down under.
Well, that's true, you know, with the internet and so forth.
That's right.
People can tune in quite easily. But no, there is no South Star. They do use some configuration known as the Southern Cross. Mm-hmm. Now, the Southern Cross, four very bright stars, it's not something we see from here, but in the southern skies, they can use that. It kind of points in the direction of where a South Star would be, but there is no South Star.
Okay. And I should read this one now because this will be in effect for about three more minutes. We heard from Nichol in Guilford, and he wanted to remind us that we're going to be looking for the Perseids, of course, but he said, according to the Heavens Above website, there will be a flyover of the International Space Station that will coincide with the start of tonight's show. He said, specifically, it will rise in the northwest at 9:02, set in the northeast at about 9:10, so in a couple more minutes.
Excellent.
And then it will fly, have another flyover starting about 10:40 tonight. So another thing to look for. So you mentioned the Big Dipper and the Summer Triangle and Antares. Why are these important? Why are these necessary to orient us?
Well, what I found is that there are any number of constellations that you can see on a given evening.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are faint. Some of them, you know, they don't necessarily look like what they've been described as, so that's going to make it a challenge. Whereas the Big Dipper, probably the most familiar pattern in the sky. I've actually met a gentleman several years ago from Australia. And one of the reasons that he traveled to the United States, he had a few, but one of the reasons is he wanted to see the Big Dipper because they don't see it from Australia.
Oh, my.
So it's a pattern that is almost immediately recognizable. And you know, once somebody's shown it to you, or like I said, if you follow the directions and if you have just a basic idea of which way is northwest tonight and you look about that one-third to one-quarter of the way up in the sky, it's there. The stars are relatively bright. It's a unique pattern that you don't see anyplace else. So the key ingredients here, you know, like I said, I found that selecting just two or three things to look for, that's great. Now, the other advantage, again, you know, we mentioned the Summer Triangle. And of course, that happens to be sitting in the Milky Way, but as does Antares, that red star that I mentioned in Scorpio. You know, the other thing that I like about all three of those is that once you find those, you can actually go back to them and locate other things in the sky.
Oh, that's interesting. We're speaking with Mark Breen of the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium. He's the host of the Eye on the Night Sky on VPR. And we're asking you to turn your eyes onto the night sky along with us tonight. If you have questions or comments about what you see, you can give us a call now. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send an email to community@vpr.net. So the Antares that you mentioned, the red star, and I'm sitting in my backyard with the naked eye. Will it appear red to me this evening out looking out into the sky?
Yeah, well, now star color is kind of interesting in terms of both perception and even the fact that they are colored. But let's start with, you know, what do you actually see?
Mm-hmm.
So stars, when you first go out and you look very casually and quickly, they all look like little spots of white light. But as you start looking at them more carefully, then you'll notice that there are, you know, different slight differences in that white. So this you would describe as reddish, but it's still a bright red, you know, almost a piercing red as far as that's concerned. And so I think sometimes an easier way to start discerning star color, and this has been discussed for thousands of years, by the way. This, you know, I mean, Ptolemy and, you know, Aristotle were wrestling with the same thing. If you start comparing it with another star, then you start to get a sense of, oh, okay, I can see where that one has more red than this other one. So a good comparison, just to do that for tonight, if you look at Antares, just to its right, not very far, there's actually a line of three vertical stars which form the head and shoulders of the Scorpion. The middle star, named Dushubha is a whitish-blue color. So that gives you a nice contrast right there. Now, it's not as bright as Antares, but it has a different color, and so that would be a great place to compare them.
So the Big Dipper, as you mentioned, one of the most recognizable constellations, brings people from down under up to the northern hemisphere to see it. But why is it so important for stargazers to find?
Well, one of the first things that we started with, you can find the North Star.
Yep.
Now, you know, here I've been describing, look in the east or look in the south and so forth. There aren't little red direction lights out there. Now, fortunately,
I wish.
Yes. On the other hand, though, technology is changing things very rapidly. I'm sure there are people out there right this second with some app on their phone or on their iPad where you can actually hold it up to the sky. And it's telling you, it's identifying objects out there, but it's also telling you which direction you're looking in. And, you know, your phone can do sort of the same thing. But suppose you don't have that with you. Finding the North Star gives you your directions, because obviously opposite of north is south, and then you just have to figure out east and west. So that's one of the reasons that I find the Big Dipper very helpful, very important that way. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, as I mentioned, you can actually go out and find other things. And let's do that now.
Okay.
Looking at the Big Dipper, and this time we'll use the handle part, and sort of imagine those stars connected with a nice curve, or arc, A-R-C. Now, if you follow that curve, that arc, you can follow it to a noticeably bright star in the west. It's much higher up and to the right of the moon, just in terms of where we're looking. That really bright star, the brightest in the summer sky, is known as Arcturus. So there's this old little catchphrase, maybe the first thing that I remember hearing in a planetarium years ago, you arc to Arcturus. Oh. So you're using the stars of the Big Dipper. It gives you a direction to look and then pinpoints you to that particular star.
Does the appearance of the Big Dipper change over time?
Well, I guess time's a relative thing here.
Yeah, that's a great.
So there are two things that are definitely worth mentioning about that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, where the Dipper is now is not where you're going to see it 2 hours from now. The Earth, of course, is moving, and that's one of the key things about the North Star. The North Star is positioned above the North Pole, which doesn't move. That's the pivot point. So it appears through the night that the Big Dipper will gradually make a trip around the North Star. Now, it won't make a complete trip because the sun comes out and you don't see half of its trip or a little more that this time of year. But tomorrow night, it will have moved all the way back around. You'll see it back in the same spot again. So there is one motion. The Earth is also going around the sun. So that's going to shift your view in a very slight fashion from one night to the other. But over the course of the entire year, Big Dipper is in the northwest this time of year. It's due north and very low in the sky in November. In December, January, and February, it swings up into the northeast. By April and May, it's just about over the top of your head, and then it swings down during the summer months to get back to where you see it now. So those are the two changes that you can observe, again, sometimes over a course of a long period of time. But if we wanted to extend that just a little bit longer, let's say 50,000 years, those stars are actually in motion themselves. And the star that's on the top right corner of the dipper part.
Mm-hmm.
That's heading off to the right, and the star on the very end of the tail is dropping straight down. So it's actually going to change it, what it looks like, if you hang around for another 50,000 years.
Which I plan to do.
Okay.
I'm talking to Mark Breen. This is the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. We'd love to hear from you if you're outside taking in this beautiful night canopy and have some questions for Mark. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email community@vpr.net. Mark, I hate to slight the little brother, the Little Dipper. So where's the Little Dipper hanging out tonight?
Well, we've actually seen at least a glimpse of it. It turns out that the North Star is the end of the handle of the Little Dipper. And again, you know, I mentioned the Big Dipper, key thing to find. It gets you to the North Star, and the North Star, in turn, shows you the Little Dipper. Now, the Little Dipper stars are not as bright as the Big Dipper, but same basic pattern in terms of three stars on its handle, four stars, and a little box for the Dipper part. In this case, as you're looking at the North Star, look up and you'll see a couple of stars kind of bending a little bit more to the left. Those are the handle stars. And just above that, again, curving a bit to the left, you'll find a little box of fainter stars. That is the Little Dipper. Obviously, not as bright. Also, one of the things we haven't mentioned, we've got the Big and Little Dippers there.
Mm-hmm.
They're also the Big and Little Bears.
Ah.
That one is a bit of a stretch as far as the imagination is concerned. there are some fainter stars, and that would be pretty tough to just simply describe, but basically they are off to the right of the Big Dipper and a little bit lower. That's where the head is positioned. And then down to the lower left would be the body and legs, which leaves the handle part. The handle is the very long, bushy tail of the Big Dipper.
We have a call. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say bears don't have long tails, but they do in the sky.
Well, we have a call from Rose in Barrie. So let's see what question she has for you. Rose? Welcome to... Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
What's your question for Mark?
I was wondering what your favorite constellation is and why.
Ooh, tough choice.
You've got to pick a favorite, Mark.
I've got to pick a favorite. Well, one of my favorites, and definitely would be in the top bunch, might be a constellation called Perseus, which is, in fact, the constellation that the Perseid meteor shower is named after. But here's why it would be my favorite. It has actually not anything to do with the meteor shower. It has to do with the fact that this constellation has a star within it that I think actually helped create at least one of the myths in ancient Greek times. So in Perseus, there's a star named Algol, A-L-G-O-L.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Algol in Arabic is translated as the ghoul or the ghost. The reason is that star is not always the same brightness in the sky. Now, that's pretty weird because, and this is certainly part of even Greek philosophy, the stars were so consistent, so exactly the same in the same place, the same configuration. They were so steady, so perfect, that that's how they viewed the sky. The sky was perfection. The sky was the heavens.
Mm.
Now, the earth, you know, rivers run crooked, mountains are jagged, the weather obviously changes, so things are imperfect down here. But this star Algol, it changes brightness. Some nights it's bright, some nights it's not. They never knew which night it was going to be. So they decided not only was that star imperfect, they thought the star was evil.
Oh.
And that became the ghoul or the ghost, and in fact became part of the story of Perseus rescuing the beautiful princess Andromeda. But one of the things that happens is that before he can do that, he actually has challenged this horrible Gorgon known as Medusa. Now, Medusa is one of those classic Halloween costumes. She has snakes coming out of her head, for example, but the worst thing were her eyes. Her eyes really were kind of evil. If you looked at her eyes, you got turned into stone.
Mm.
And that star may have actually been the inspiration for that story. And so that's just one of the reasons I just love Perseus.
I love that. Let's see if Rose is still with us, see if she has a favorite. Rose, your favorite constellation?
Nothing like that, but that's really, that's really amazing. My brother, though, is studying propulsion and space at Purdue, and so it's really cool that you guys are doing this. That's beautiful. Maybe that'll be my favorite constellation now.
All right. Thanks, Rose. That's a great school for astronauts, correct? Mm-hmm. Purdue.
Yes.
I guess Orion's Belt would have to be my favorite because I can usually find that every once in a while. So let's check in with John in Weathersfield. John, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good evening. First of all, we have seen several shooting stars this evening, and we also spotted the space station going over. What my question is, are there any galaxies that you can see with your bare eyes this evening?
There is one, and it's the only galaxy that you can see with your own eyes. Now, this is a little bit of a challenge, but I think we're up for it. First of all, we've got some stars that are going to help us in the northeast. So that's the direction we're going to look. As you look to the northeast, and I'd say about a third of the way up in the sky, you may see somewhat of a W shape, let's describe it that way, kind of a zigzag pattern of stars. This is Cassiopeia, the queen. Now, we're going to use the stars on the kind of the right-hand side. There are three of them, and they point down toward the horizon and toward the right. So using that, we come to a line of three stars, actually. So you're actually kind of aimed for the middle star, but there's a star off to the right, another star off to the left, so kind of a not quite a straight line, a curve of three medium bright stars. Now, at the middle star, go back up two fainter stars. So you've got to the middle star, you go up two fainter stars, and now we have to do something that it's definitely a challenge. What I want you to do is not look at that spot. In other words, look just a little bit to the right or the left. Above or below would work as well. But what you're trying to do is not look directly as you go up two stars, but look just a little bit to the right or left of that area. And the reason is the light from this very faint galaxy, known as the Andromeda Galaxy, needs to hit a part of your eye that's more sensitive to light. The center of your eye actually is a little more sensitive to color as opposed to light. So when you look a slight bit off to the left or right, that light from that very faint galaxy actually hits a more sensitive part of your eye. So there is the only galaxy that human eyes can see.
We're speaking with Mark Breen of the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium. He's the host of the Eye on the Night Sky, and this is Eye on the Sky's Stargazing Party on VPR. We'd love to have you join the conversation with your questions or let us know what you're seeing. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send an email to community@vpr.net. Well, we've heard that some have started to see the meteor shower. So why don't you tell us a little bit about these meteors that people are seeing?
Sure.
Or we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Perseid meteor shower is probably, I'd say it's the most popular meteor shower during the year for two reasons. It's got a fair number of meteors, so that's good. It also happens at a time of year that's pretty comfortable. There are a few meteor showers that actually feature more meteors. But one of them's in December, and it's either cloudy or really cold, and the same story in January. And so those tend to be not nearly as popular. So the Perseid meteor shower, now you may notice if you start finding out about other meteor showers, I'll just quick list the Lyrid meteor shower, the Geminid meteor shower. You notice they all end with the id. Mm-hmm. That just means belonging to. So what they did is they started describing meteor showers from the constellation or the section of the sky that they seem to come from. And so these come from approximately the location of Perseus, who is just now starting to rise into the northeastern skies. What you would expect to see in terms of these meteors is the relatively quick moving, and most of them are faint, but there's a kind of a nice mix of fainter and more moderately bright meteors out of the Perseids, and just every once in a while you get a really bright one coming out. The source material for this is a comet that's been going around the sun for centuries. The last time it went by, back in the 1990s. And as it goes by, the sun vaporizes the ice, but it's not pure ice. In fact, comets were once described as dirty snowballs. So you've got ice, but it's embedded with tiny little fragments of rock. Some of them dust-sized, some of them pebbles, a few of them a little bit larger than that. But as a rule, pretty tiny stuff. Gravel, think of it that way. And so as the sun obviously vaporizes the ice, the tiny particles are released, and they stay on the comet's orbit. Now, that comet's orbit happens to cross very close to the Earth's orbit, not in a collision course sort of way, but just in a way so that as the Earth, in its orbit, goes through that section where the comet goes by, we run into those particles. And so that's why it's so consistent that every year on August 11th, 12th, and 13th, you see these shooting stars. And so we're running into these objects. And I guess that's kind of an interesting thing in itself. Yeah. When you see them streaking across the sky, it sounds like they're hurrying into the Earth, maybe pulled by our gravity, when in fact, the Earth is actually running into them. They're out there minding their own business when the Earth sweeps through this section at a wonderful speed of 66,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
And we run into those particles. Well, when we do that, at 66,000 miles an hour, a little piece of rock about the size of a garden pea starts zipping through the atmosphere, burning up, and that's what we see, that bright streak of light. There's your meteor.
And this is all thanks to Comet Swift-Tuttle, right?
That's correct, yes.
So how long will this comet continue to provide this August show for us?
Well, I believe its orbit is somewhere in the neighborhood of 135 years between visits around.
Mm-hmm.
And that suggests that it may have another, say, 20 or 25 visits left in it, so to say. So well after you and I have retired.
That's what I'm worried about. I'm wondering how long you and I can do this. So I'll see you next year for sure.
Oh yes.
You're listening to the Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. You can join the conversation about what you see outside right now in the mid-August skies, and you can call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or send an email to community@vpr.net.
Fires make big headlines in Vermont, especially when terrified tenants are displaced from their apartments. I'm Charlotte Albright. Is our code inspection rigorous enough? How can we prevent fires and detect them faster? VPR examines these questions in our special series, Burned Out, Vermont's Apartment Fires. Listen during Morning Edition and follow the series at vpr.net.
VPR is listener-supported with additional funding from Guild & Company, Williston Road, South Burlington, offering casual fare with house dry-aged steaks, local burgers, and craft cocktails. And from Gallagher Flynn & Company, offering diversified professional services, including executive recruiting, forensic, and valuation services. GFC.com.
Welcome back to the Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. I'm Rick Singeri. And I hope you found your way outside. You're taking in the clear view of the night sky. If not, grab that radio, head outside and join us. And if you have questions for our guest, Eye on the Sky meteorologist Mark Breen, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send comments or questions to community@vpr.net. And let's talk to Kirk in Shaftesbury. Kirk, you have a question or comment? What are you seeing?
Well, what I'm seeing is some clouds are coming in from the south, so they're starting to obscure my view in that direction. But what my question is, if I haven't seen one yet, but if I do see a shooting star down here in Bennington County, would someone up in, let's say, St. Albans or the Northeast Kingdom see the same thing at essentially the same angle?
Great question.
Yes and no. So they would see the same shooting star or meteor because they generally burn up somewhere about 60 or 70 miles above the Earth's surface. But because it is relatively close to the Earth's surface, they would see it at a different angle. So in other words, if you're looking, let's say, off to the northeast and you see it that way, somebody maybe in northern New Hampshire, they might see it almost straight overhead.
Hmm. Well, let's take a call from New Hampshire. Don is in Clarksville, New Hampshire. Don, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm in northern New Hampshire, Clarksville, which is almost the tip of the state,
but indeed,
south of Pittsburgh.
Wow.
If you know where that is.
I do.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And looking west, almost due west, almost every night, I see the first star or planet west. It's up about a quarter or a third up. And it's there every single night. It's the first one. Is that a star or a planet? What is that? Jupiter or Mars? Or...
Okay, now, when you say it's about a quarter to a third up, so like right now, or can you see it in that approximate direction?
It's hard to find it right now because
okay.
It's different. This is the first one I see. And mm-hmm. Of course, when all the other stars are out, I can't really pick it out. But
sure.
It's always in the same place. In fact, it's not even dark, and I see it.
Okay.
Almost dark, but
yep.
It's there every night.
Yep. So I'm going to hazard a guess that I'm thinking that, especially if you're seeing it probably maybe 20 minutes after the sunset, you're probably catching a view of Venus. Venus has just kind of returned to the evening sky, so to say. But the way the orbit of the Earth works out this time of year and so forth, it winds up not climbing very high up into the sky. But it would be definitely one of the first things you'd see, and like you said, long before any of the other stars would appear. And Venus will be the first star in the skies for the next, about 4 or 5 months, right on through this upcoming fall, and later this fall, as we get into November, December, it'll actually climb up a little bit higher. But you'll have some great views of Venus just about every clear night.
So, Mark, talking about planets in addition to Venus, anything else we'd be seeing now or through the fall, any other planets?
Well, right now, of course, I mentioned Venus, and we got mm-hmm. Saturn that is above the moon. Now, as we go into the late night hours for those night owls, coming up early in the morning, we do have the planets, Jupiter and Mars, that are now showing up. But like I said, they are very early. Just to give you some sense of that, Jupiter rises tomorrow morning right around 2:30, which means, if you happen to be, maybe you're up early but not out in the middle of the night, somewhere between 4:30 and 5 o'clock, you may actually pick it up, so to say, only because it is noticeably bright. It is much brighter than anything else in the sky except for the moon and the sun. And, it would not be quite as bright as the planet Venus, but they're not in the same section of the sky, so there's no confusion there right now. But anyway, Jupiter, wonderfully bright in the early morning skies.
Mm-hmm.
And Mars is out, but I think you'd be pretty challenged to find it. It just happens that it's near a pair of stars. They're about the same brightness, close together, known as the twins of Gemini. And Mars is just a little bit to their right. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to mention Jupiter and Mars is that give them some time. And through time, they'll actually start appearing out in the evening skies. Now, it's going to take a while, but Jupiter will be out in the evening skies by the end of this year.
Nice.
And Mars, you'll have to wait till next spring. But it's worth the wait.
Be patient.
Yeah, because Mars next spring will be really, really bright. Just about as bright as Jupiter. Mars is very fascinating that way. It has the biggest range of brightness of any comet. It can be very dim. It can be really bright. So Mars is always interesting to keep track of.
Wow. David wrote to us, and he says, I'm out with my daughter. She pointed out there are 2 naked eye galaxies in sight, Andromeda plus the Milky Way.
Oh, absolutely. Got me on that one.
and let's take a call from Peter in Westminster West. Peter, thanks for joining us. What's your question or comment for Mark Breen?
In the south-southeast in the Milky Way, there's a group of five stars. They're about the same magnitude, and they're about the same size. Four of them make up a triangle, and the other one is a little bit of a tail, sort of like a kite. I'm wondering what constellation that might be.
Ah, so you're looking in the south. Now, if you kind of get to, let's see, you're going to have to add maybe just a couple more stars. I'm looking at eight in total, but I think you can imagine a teapot over there. The way the teapot is shaped, it's tipped just a little bit to the right and down, and there's kind of a triangular lid on the top, and below that would be the teapot itself. On the left side of that, there's a couple of stars, and they help to create a handle, and to the right, just one star, and that becomes the spout of the teapot. Now, the teapot is not a constellation in itself. It is part of the constellation Sagittarius. The picture of Sagittarius is supposed to be a centaur with a bow and arrow. So I'm going to leave the teapot as the easier thing to look for as opposed to a half-man, half-horse drawing a bow and arrow.
I never thought of it as a teapot before.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to the Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. You can join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. And let's talk to Peter in Vergennes now. Peter, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I do have a question. When I think about the Earth, as you described it, moving through space at 66,000 miles an hour, hitting this cloud of debris, I picture bugs bouncing off my windshield as I drive down Route 7. Why don't all of the meteors in our meteor shower go in the same direction? Why do they hit in all different directions? And just a follow-up question, and I'll hang up and listen, is at this time of year, at what time of the day is Vermont sort of at the leading edge of that path around the sun? When are we in front of the car, so to speak?
Ah, okay. Well, let me go to the first part, that illusion that they should, as you sort of imagine it, all go in the same direction when, in fact, they seem to go in different directions. Think of the headlights as you're driving through a snowstorm. I think that's the best description that I can think of, where even though you're driving into the snowflakes, and basically the snowflakes are all kind of going at you at the same direction, but they appear to be radiating from a point where your headlights are aimed, and they kind of go off in different directions. So that might be the best way to describe it. It has to do with the fact of distance as the Earth is running into it. So they're all, kind of coming from the same spot, but some of them are racing off above you to the right or to the left or down below you a little bit, and so that gives it that radiant sort of appearance. Now, in terms of when is Vermont in direct line with that travel, essentially it would be sunrise, though we are never exactly right in the middle because we're in the northern hemisphere. So only locations between, say, 23 degrees north and 23 degrees south, known, if you look on an atlas, you'll see them as these dotted lines called the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. Those describe the spots where the sun is directly overhead. But in terms of the Earth traveling along that line, of course, sunrise would be when we would be, kind of getting right at that dead-on sort of spot.
I'm a little bit like a deer in a headlight right now. I just want to clarify one thing. So are they actually shooting off in different directions, or do they just appear that way to us?
They just appear that way to us. Although I should mention, I actually sort of almost anticipated our caller's question. Some meteors, if the angle is just right, they actually do bounce off the Earth's atmosphere. So it's sort of like skimming a rock on a pond. If the angle is shallow enough, so basically very close to the top or the bottom of the Earth, the northern or southern polar regions, they actually could glance off the edge.
Are we getting hit by any of these meteors as we slide through the shower?
Yeah, well, nearly all of these, and this is typical in basically all the common meteor showers, the chunks of rock that they're made out of, and it is rock, it's not metal, the chunks of rock tend to be relatively small, so 99.9% of them burn up. So we don't tend to get meteorites, a chunk of rock that actually makes it to the ground, mm-hmm. out of these particular situations.
All right. Let's take another call. Julia from Waterbury is calling. Julia, thanks for giving us a call this evening. What's up?
Hi. My science teacher was telling me about a comet that might be coming this fall that will be visible for a very long time. And I'm not really understanding how a comet can be visible for that long. So I was wondering if you could tell me about that.
Sure. We're probably talking about Comet Ison. Ison is the, I think it's the International Scientific Observing Network. And so this actually network of telescopes discovered this particular comet, and that's how it gets its name. Now, Comet Ison is just now becoming visible. In fact, I was just looking today to see if the information has come in yet. There's a satellite out in space, actually an old spacecraft known as Deep Impact, and it's still active. They're trying to get images of this comet because it's been too close to the sun to observe. So they're about to get some images of it, and that's going to help us understand it just a little bit more. They've already seen it, but then it was, the sun was basically in the way. So what's going to be happening is this comet will be getting closer and closer to the sun as we go through the rest of this fall, and it'll go as close to the sun as possible on November 28th. Now, just how close is going to be one of, I guess, three things that scientists are thinking about in terms of this comet. The comet is going to come very close to the sun. In fact, it may come so close to the sun that it'll completely burn up, vaporize, it's going to be gone. Yeah. So we'll see it briefly as opposed to seeing it for a long time, and that's going to be it.
We don't like that scenario.
No, we don't like that scenario. Another possibility is that it won't necessarily break up, but it's a relatively new comet. This is an odd phrase. This comet is about 4.5 billion years old. When I say new, this is likely its first trip in to the middle of the solar system. And so this is the first time the sun's been vaporizing stuff off of it. So another possibility is that once the sun vaporizes enough stuff, it'll stop being very active. It'll still have a little bit of stuff coming off of it. This is, for folks that remember, back to the 1970s, there was a comet named Kohoutek.
Oh, yeah.
And there were headlines that it was going to be the comet of the century, and it was a dud. And that's one of the things they learned from that, was that newer comets, comets that are making their first pass in through the sun, sometimes don't produce. The third scenario is that it will get close enough to the sun that it'll burn off some of that crust that'll hold it back, and it'll blaze out and be amazingly bright this December. It could be somewhat bright in November, but the key time of year actually turns out to be in December. So that'll be something, in terms of thinking about when are you going to see it at its best. It'll be low in the skies, in the morning sunlight, so it's in the pre-dawn hours and all the way into possibly even daylight, but December 1st to the 10th, that's the key time to think of it. I don't think we're going to necessarily see it for a long time because it's going around the sun very quickly,
mm-hmm.
it's actually going to fade out noticeably toward the middle and end of December. But if it puts on a great show between December 1st and 10th.
Still could be an exciting event.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. Join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Cooper. He's in Troy, New Hampshire. Cooper, welcome to the program. Cooper, you there?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm here. I was wondering what causes a streak behind a meteor. Peru, New York, rather. Yeah, but I'm calling from Peru, New York.
Oh, Peru, New York.
Oh, Peru, okay. New York. Oh, sure. Yep. Okay, so what we're seeing, there are actually a couple things that go on with the meteors, these chunks of rock. One of the things is that they're actually pushing, because the Earth is moving so quickly, and therefore they are going very quickly, 66,000 miles an hour, more or less, it actually heats up the air just in front of it because the air compacts. And that's one of the things that kind of gives its glow, especially on the front part of it. But the particles themselves are burning up. And as those particles get superheated, that forms that trail that you see. So it's part of the process of them burning up is they disintegrate into tiny little particles, and that creates the tail.
Mm. Let's take another call. Ann is calling from Morrisville. Ann, welcome to the program. How you doing? Ann?
Hi, Ann.
Okay, well, oh, there she is. Hi, Ann. Did you have a question for us?
I wanted to see if they made an iPad app that would help me better understand the constellations in the sky, like Leo the Lion.
Yes, they do. But you're talking to an inexperienced iPad user. So I don't know the name of it. There are a few of them out there. And I think if you just did a Google search and tried to find one... a lot of them are made so that they will show you, and you can probably choose some options, like the pattern of the constellation, and as you move your iPad around, it'll show you what you're looking at. So that's the kind that I would look for. So I don't have a name. I'm sure a few of our listeners would be out there, and they have that information.
All right. If you do know a great app to help Ann, let us know. We'll pass that along to her. And so everyone's out looking at this Perseid meteor shower. Is there a good time of the night, a better time of the night, Mark, to catch some of these meteors?
Yes. Now, of course, we obviously plan this for the evening because it's a nice time for folks to be out. It's a reasonable time for folks to be out. But quite honestly, the best meteors are going to be somewhere between 2 and about 4:30 tomorrow morning. And there's a specific reason for that. Mm-hmm. What happens is, of course, as I mentioned, we're running into the particles. But if you think about the Earth spinning around, we've just finished turning away from the sun. And turning away from the sun means we're kind of going away from the direction that we're traveling in our orbit around the sun. So what happens in the hours after midnight is as we continue to rotate around, we start running back into the direction that we're traveling. And so it's like sweeping into the particles, and that's why they're better seen in the hours, you know, later at night, certainly after midnight, but between 2 and about 4:30 tends to be the prime time. And that's not true for just the Perseids. That is generally true for all meteor showers, or even, you know, you can see meteors on any night. You don't have to wait for the Perseids.
There are other showers this month, aren't there?
There are a few going on right now. One of them is the Delta Aquarid meteor shower.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs, actually, it's got a 3-week run. It goes for the last about week or so of July and the first week and a half of August. So there's a kind of a long stretched out period for that. But on any night, there are enough pieces of debris that we can see on the average, about 5 or 6 per hour. So about 1 every 10 minutes after midnight.
It's a fascinating place out there, isn't it? All right, I think you need to put your meteorologist hat back on. Mary in White River Junction is calling, and I think she has a weather question for you. Hi, Mary. What's up?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm just worried because it's like really overcast here. I can see the moon through the clouds, but there's a lot of clouds in the southern part here, you know, in facing south.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's going to move out of the way between 2 and 4.
I don't know the exact timing of it. I'm actually kind of peeking at my satellite pictures right now, and there are some thin spots in those clouds. In other words, I think the clouds may be breaking up right now. Maybe our listeners can confirm, but over toward Lake George and kind of stretching down just to the west of Bennington. And then there's another patch of clearing that's out across central New York State, out near from Binghamton up toward Utica. So it's not going to be, certainly not going to be clear, but you may have some periods of clearer skies coming along. One of them I'm going to estimate is going to be there in about an hour and a half to 2 hours from now, and the other one maybe about 4 or 5 hours from now. Maybe that's the one that'll give you a good view.
Ah, there is hope this evening. All right. If you want to join the conversation on this Eye in the Sky stargazing party, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Eric in Guilford. Hi, Eric. What's your question for Mark?
Mike, it's not so much a question, but an earlier caller asked what Mark's favorite constellation was. And I was thinking that my favorite constellation is a very small one called Dolphinus, the dolphin, also known as Job's coffin. And then a subsequent caller called up and asked about like a kite type of configuration with a tail. And I thought, well, great, he's describing the dolphin, but then Mark went on to assume that he was talking about Sagittarius. But it's actually the dolphin, which is just to the right of Altair. To the left of Altair.
Right, yeah. I was basing that on the caller's description that he was looking to the south. You know, Delphinius the dolphin's a wonderful, very tiny constellation, you're right. But if we're looking at the summer triangle, one of the things that we talked about to kind of kick off the program in terms of orienting people to the skies. So if you're looking at the summer triangle right now, I look kind of high in the east-southeast, below the summer triangle and just below the band of the Milky Way is where you'll see what our current caller is describing, is that wonderful kind of kite-like pattern. There are four stars that make kind of a diamond shape, and then a few more stars kind of trailing off to the right. So ancients kind of imagined that as a dolphin jumping up and out of the water, but indeed you could certainly imagine it as a kite as well.
All kinds of things up there. Dolphins, teapots, ghouls. It's a fabulous place to let your mind wander. Let's talk to Karen in Barrie. Karen, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment for Mark?
Hi. My brother once tried to explain to me a thing called Olber's Paradox, and I just never really got it, but it's about the night sky, and it seemed like it might be appropriate for this.
I'm not touching that.
Okay. So Olber's Paradox. The basic tenet of this is that there are stars pretty much in every direction. And so shouldn't there be, instead of a night sky, shouldn't it all be bright? So that's kind of the conundrum, you know, in terms of why would that happen? So in some ways it's kind of a riddle. The idea is that if you wanted to sort of come up with a basic explanation, is that although there is light in all directions, every star that's producing light, you're only really seeing the very, you know, light that's absolutely straight onto your eye. And all the other light from that star is kind of going away off to the side. So the combination of that means that gradually some of that light from that star is going to dissipate relative to you. So the end result is, although there appear to be stars in every single direction, not all of that light can get to your eye. So that's, it is a bit of a paradox, so we wouldn't expect to have a single, simple, there's the answer, but that's the best understanding of it that I have.
Excellent. And we had a caller earlier this evening who was looking for a recommendation for an app, and I think we have an answer from Andrew in Underhill. Andrew, can you help us out?
I can. Yeah, there's an app out there called Starwalk. It's the one that gets the most reviews. It's got, I don't know, like 4 stars. It's, there's a bunch of them out there. So if you type in, like, stars in the app store, you know, something's going to pop up. You know, you'll want to make your search. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want games in there. You want to search for educational apps, and you should be able to find it just easily enough.
And the one that you just mentioned, Starwalk, that's the name I'm probably most familiar with.
Andrew, is that one you use yourself?
It is, yeah.
Excellent. You can recommend
it. It works
that
well. I'm pretty sure that you need Wi-Fi for it, though.
Okay.
You're not going to just be able to walk out in the middle of the field or go hiking up on Mount Mansfield. unless you have 3G.
Right.
Or 4G. If you have that kind of service, then you should be able to use it just fine. But I'm pretty sure that it uses an internet connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ones on the phones, though, that you just mentioned, you know, I have seen those in operation off in the field. So,
excellent. Thank you, Andrew. Let's take another call. We have Dash from Morrisville on the line. Dash, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How you doing?
Good. So my question is, what is the realistic probability of any of these, you know, flying things of meteor rock having, like, evidence of extraterrestrialness?
Ah.
That's what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, so we've been mentioning that many of these, in fact, the majority of these particles come from comets and they burn up in our atmosphere. But that's not all of the material that creates meteors and meteorites. There are some pieces that have been recovered on the Earth of both the Moon and of Mars. Now, several years ago, one of the pieces that was recovered from Mars, under a microscopic look at it, appeared to have some kind of fossilized form to it. It basically looked like a little tiny worm, like a bacteria, basically. Now, there are varying interpretations of what that is. It certainly means that one of the things that is in the planning stages in terms of exploring Mars is to actually be able to take some rocks from Mars and bring them back to the Earth so we can look at them in that kind of rigorous detail. So in the meantime, we can only wonder about that. One thing that has been suggested is that some of these rocks do contain carbonaceous materials, carbon, and that may have been at least, possibly part of the ingredients that kicked off the development of life on the Earth. No certainties about that, but that's one possibility.
Okay. I think we have to call for time for just one very quick call. Joanne from Heartland. Joanne, what's your question?
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I want to know, I got up last night in the middle of the night in anticipation of it being cloudy, which it is, and I saw several meteors. I want to know, why do they look different? Some look like pencil lines. Some look very, very fuzzy.
All right, let's let Mark answer that.
Sure. They all have different sizes to them, and so that's going to really make a difference. And some of them do have, slightly different speeds, so there's going to be, that element as well. But the idea here is that if you got a large piece, it may resist burning up that much more, so it's going to be a big bolder streak of light. And a tiny little fragment, you'll see this swift little tiny thin line, and then it's gone.
Wow. Mark Breen, thanks so much for a great evening taking us on this tour of the sky.
Oh, I have so much fun with this every year.
Mark Breen is the Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury, as well as an Eye on the Sky meteorologist and host of Eye on the Night Sky every weekday afternoon on VPR. And this has been the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury. This program was produced by Peter Biello with production assistance from Michelle Owens. Mary Williams directed the show. And don't forget, the conversation continues online on our Facebook page. You can check it out. Tell us what your favorite constellation is or what you've seen tonight. I'm Rick Zingari. Thanks for listening. Have a great night.